welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. I hope you've enjoyed a sunny and sensational Memorial Day, and some great summer getaways are beginning to percolate in your mind. I always say a great trip deserves a great read. There's a new crop of celebrity bios written by men and women frequently in the Hollywood headlines. And the bonus? All of today's titles are performed by the authors. So you're assured these audiobooks have the straight story. My guest today, Susie Kurtz, is an incredibly talented, multidimensional actress with so much to share. We'll speak with her about her new biography, Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. In Candace Bergen's new biography, A Fine Romance, she shares the big events: her marriage to French director Louis Malle, the birth of her daughter, Murphy Brown, widowhood, falling in love again, and watching her daughter blossom. A Fine Romance begins with Bergen's charming first husband, Louis Malle, whose huge appetite for life broadened her horizons and whose occasional darkness never diminished their love for each other. But her real romance begins when she discovers an overpowering love for her daughter after years of ambivalence about motherhood. As Chloe grows, Bergen finds her comic genius in the biggest TV role of her career, Murphy Brown, and makes unwanted headlines when Dan Quayle puts her into the 1992 presidential campaign. 15 years into their marriage, Malle is diagnosed with cancer, and Candace is unflinching in describing her despair over his death. But after years of widowhood, she feels the sweet shock of finding a different kind of soulmate. Candace takes us through the first years of her new marriage, of watching Chloe leave home and flourish, and the comedy of a losing battle against those damn wrinkles and extra pounds.
In those early days, all we wanted was to spend time with each other. Harold Pinter asked Louis to direct his script of his play Betrayal. "I'm very flattered," Louis told him, "but I can't do that now. I just want to be with Candace and love Candace." Soon after Louis and I began seeing each other, we stayed at a friend's flat in London. One day he left me a huge postcard from Disneyland featuring Jiminy Cricket peering delightedly into the window of a candy store. On the back he wrote, "You're just about to enter the second third of your life, which you will devote entirely to the pleasure principle. You know, it takes that amount of time to get rid of the stiffness, the fears, the hang-ups of adolescence. At 20, you were very old. Probably, what do I know? And it takes time to become young again, to find the child in you. I love you so much, it is like the sun in my eyes, walking in a forest. I am naked because I don't have to hide anything anymore. The world is my nest, my theater, my greenhouse. I feel like a bird. See you tonight." Whenever we did need to be apart because of work obligations, the blessing in disguise was my discovery of Louis, a legendary letter writer. From Mr. to Mrs. Louis Bergen. "My darling, I love you more and more. I miss you more and more. And it's fun, fabulous fun to be with you. I am looking forward to all these years ahead of us. We have so much to do together, so much to find out about ourselves and the world. I look at everything now with new eyes. I feel differently, and you're always with me. Flame, heart, body, mind, touch, so tender, so frail, so powerful. Your smile in the morning, your innocence and your wisdom. I am crazy. I am happy. Thank you, 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 you. L.B." A postcard mailed from the Sheraton Carlton in Washington, D.C. "Life with you is a feast, Candy, a melody, a delicate happening." and this from July 7, 1981. You is only you. There is nobody else you. Love is you. Life is you. Fun is you. I dance my body and mind with you. I am you. So there. The world is tough without you, you know. In late 1982, I flew out to Dubrovnik, Yugoslavia, to vamp it up in a fright wig as the evil Morgan Le Fay in a TV miniseries, Arthur the King. It wasn't brilliant filmmaking, but working with Malcolm McDowell, Liam Neeson, and Rupert Everett, who turned out to be a brilliant pianist, was great fun. This was my first major separation from Louis, 3 weeks apart. The separation was almost worth it, because Louis, who'd gone to Paris to visit Justine, wrote me an almost constant stream of love letters. November 12, 1982. My darling, I was just speaking to you, your first call from Dubrovnik. Each time I hear your voice, it does go from my ear to my heart and then radiates through my entire body. When your voice says, my darling, I feel together again. I feel myself again. I miss you so much, but you're so much with me, you know. It's not the real thing, but sometimes I smell you, touch you, your body is close, your wonderful smile, your love for me. I feel all that almost in front of me. Telepathy, my love, telepathy. I see you reading at this minute, reading Salambo in your little room on the sea. I love you, L.
That was a sampling of A Fine Romance by Candace Bergen. Actress Swoosie Kurtz has appeared in dozens of plays, movies, and popular TV shows, including the current hit, Mike and Molly. Swoosie collected the Tony, the Drama Desk, and the Outer Critics Circle Awards, Broadway's Triple Crown, for her portrayal of Gwen in Lanford Wilson's The Fifth of July. She starred with the biggest names of stage and screen, received several Emmy and Golden Globe nominations, and won an Emmy for her guest starring performance on Carol Burnett's comedy series, Carol and Company. Today we'll speak with Swoosie about her new memoir, Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family. Welcome, Swoosie. I'm thrilled to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, I'm so happy to be here, Elaine. Thank you.
Okay, even though you've been asked this question over and over and over again, how did your parents come to name you Swoosie?
Well, my father was quite an overachiever, a real war hero, for one thing. He was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II, and he flew a plane during the war, a B-17 called the Swoos, and it was named the Swoos after a popular song that was about this strange-looking bird who was sort of half swan, half goose. And Doris, it was a funny song out at the time, and Doris Day sang it, and Bob Hope sang it, So somehow, you know, this plane was important to my dad, and somehow my parents felt this was an appropriate name for a baby. So I've lived with it all these years, but now I embrace it. You know, when I was a kid, I just desperately wanted to be Mary or Jane, but now I think it's distinctive.
Right.
It's a great legacy.
Part Swan, Part Goose chronicles your amazing career, yet it's also a tribute to your parents. Can you introduce them to the listeners?
Yeah, it really is a Valentine to my parents. My dad, as I said, was the most decorated Air Force pilot of World War II. He was also on three Olympic diving teams. And my mother was a terrific writer. She had a book published in 1945 called My Rival, the Sky, which was really the story of her and my father's meeting and courtship and marriage. And it ends with my birth. And I have, it's such a beautiful book, I have excerpts from it kind of woven into my book, all through my book, to sort of compare, you know, these two women, very strong women, where they were in their lives, say at 20 and 30, and the very different decisions that my mom and I made going on in life, and how they worked great for both of us.
Right. You shared that before you started high school, your family had moved 17 times and you had lived in 8 different states. How did that shape you?
Well, I tell you, it was the best boot camp in the world for the life I live now as an actor, you know, because it had absolutely no continuity. The only continuity were my parents and my grandparents in Omaha, Nebraska, where we would go back very often. That was my only real home and stability. It was very tough because I was an only child, and I was very shy. And so we really, I think it threw me back on my parents. I would go to them, you know, to be my best friends. And I think that's one reason the three of us became so incredibly close.
Speaking of which, I know that your high school acting teacher was a big force in your life. Was it he who started you on your path?
He really did light the fire for me. I knew before I went into his class that I wanted to be an actress, but he really showed me the way, John Engel. And he was pretty legendary at Hollywood High and then Beverly Hills High, but I went to Hollywood High for a while. And he, just a bit of interesting trivia for your listeners, he ultimately had his own career and became Quartermain on General Hospital.
You lived across the street at that time from Bob Hope. Did you ever bump into him on the street?
Absolutely. Oh, Bob and Dolores were so good to us when we first moved into that neighborhood. They welcomed us to the neighborhood by inviting us over to their house, and we went for years and years. We celebrated birthdays and anniversaries with them, and they were just, you know, wonderful to us.
Now, your first big break was an appearance, and I'm putting that in quotes, on the Donna Reed Show. Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh. Yes, well, when I was in high school, I did a play, and it was kind of a cliche story because this famous casting director, Eddie Foy III, came to see it at Hollywood High and came backstage and said, I want to cast you in the Donna Reed Show, which was, you know, on decades ago, but it was very popular then. And I was just overwhelmed because, you know, I got my SAG card and I got to get out of school to go film, and I felt like, you know, the big girl on campus. So, of course, we had all the relatives lined up all over the country when it aired, you know, watching my television debut. And it was really my first lesson in show business. You know, don't count your chickens. I was pretty much cut from it. I mean, I had a conversation on the phone with Sally Fabares, which we shot, but when it came out and was edited, you just simply saw her face the whole time, and mine was a voice on the other end.
Part Swan, Part Goose is filled with wonderful photographs, including one that features your eyeball projected over Jimi Hendrix at one of his concerts. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, that's a keeper. You know, my boyfriend for years during the 60s was Joshua White, who formed and created the now legendary Joshua Light Show, which during the 60s and early 70s was the liquid light show, the projections, you know, on the screen behind the famous singers at the Fillmore East in New York. Excuse me. And he did these amazing, and of course everybody was, you know, stoned and everything. Not us, we weren't, but people were, you know, imbibing a lot back then, and acid and various things. And you know, it was the Jefferson Airplane and the Doors and Janis Joplin. And Josh was a great graphic artist as well, and he took a photo, a close-up of my eyeball, and he blew it up, and he put it on the projection behind Jimi Hendrix when Jimi was performing live on stage, and I was part of the projection. So he took a photo of that, and I have it, so I can say I was on stage with Jimi Hendrix.
We're speaking with Susie Kurtz on The Book Report. David Letterman has made such a mark on TV with his Late Show. What was it like to work with him in a Mary Tyler Moore musical sketch show, one that also starred Michael Keaton?
It was hilarious. I don't know if you saw the other night, but about a week ago, David Letterman had Michael Keaton on as a guest, and they talked about this Mary show for about 10 minutes. It was an hour variety show, kind of like SNL, where, you know, we did sketch material, we did songs and dances and production numbers. And it was crazy because none of us were really adept at song and dance, but we were taught this, you know, intricate choreography and stuff, which none of us could really follow, especially Dave. He would actually do the warm-up, if you can believe this, for the live audience that we had. And Dave Letterman would do the warm-up, and of course he was brilliant. And I would watch him, and I would say to everybody, this guy is going to take over for Johnny Carson. And I know that sounds now like Monday morning quarterbacking, but I actually said, oh my God, this guy is amazing. And there he is.
As such an amazing actress, how do you decide which roles to accept?
Well, you know, as an actor, you don't have a lot of control as to what comes over the transom. You really, you're only, one of the only things you can do is say yes or no. I look at the woman on the page. Like, can I bring her to life? Is she someone I've played before? In which case, I really probably don't want to do it. Does she scare me? Is this scary? Like, oh, gosh, I don't know if I can do this. In which case, I have to do it.
Right. You've worked with so many superstars. If you could meet three of them again tomorrow, one for breakfast, one for lunch, and one for dinner, who would you choose and why?
Oh, that's a great question. Katharine Hepburn, because she is, I worked with her in the last movie, and the last scene she ever did on film is between the two of us. And then I think Tony Randall, because he was such a life force. We worked together on this series called Love, Sydney for a couple of years. And he just is, again, uniquely and unapologetically Tony. And let's see, the third one would probably be, I think, Carol Burnett, because just, you know, how brilliant and funny is she? It was a real pioneer at making it okay for women to be funny.
Your work in Mike and Molly allows you to work with new and upcoming talent. How has TV changed since your early work on series?
Well, it's just blown through to another level. I go to do Sisters in 1990, and the networks were very upset when they heard that we were discussing orgasms in the pilot, and a lot of affiliates started pulling out, you know, and we didn't change anything, but they would delete stuff. And then coming to do Love, Sydney I guess that was before that. That was more like the 80s. And, you know, Tony trying very, very hard to make this character of Sydney gay in a half-hour format on network television. And it pretty much got de-gayed by standards and practices. But he really tried. You know, it was kind of really the first gay character on television, or meant to be anyway. And you leap to now when we can say and do anything, even on network TV, pretty much. Cable, of course, anything goes. But, for instance, on Mike and Molly, I mean, I just feel like I embrace it and I love it, the lustiness of this character. But I really feel like a lot of the time I should be bleeped.
What's next for you?
Gosh, you know, I don't know. We have another season of Mike and Molly coming up, season 6, believe it or not. And so that will keep me in L.A. for most of next year.
Swoosie, any final thoughts about the book?
Just that the book is really, it's a love story about a family. And I dedicated it to my parents, who really gave me the world.
Swoosie, I want to congratulate you on a book that I loved from page one. And I don't say that about every book I've read.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a great book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Elaine, thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Now, let's listen to a sampling of Part Swan, Part Goose, performed by the author.
G.P. Putnam, the publishing magnate who was also the husband of Amelia Earhart, had taken an interest in my parents after they collaborated with W.L. White on the book Queens Die Proudly, which told the story of the great Flying Fortress bombers, including my father's heroically cobbled together B-17D, the Swoos. A contract was proposed and accepted. Margot was to write a war memoir from the home front perspective, titled to be determined, $250 to be remitted on signing, and $250 on delivery of the manuscript. I was born in the fall of 1944, a few weeks after Nazi forces put a brutal end to Hungarian resistance, a few weeks before U.S. troops landed in the Philippines. My father was somewhere in the thick of that as my mother and day-old me were being photographed for the newspaper. People desperately needed to see this beautiful young mother treasuring her fresh baby and believe in a God who would either bring that baby's daddy home or send straight to hell the scurvy tail gunner who took him out. I look at that photograph on a bookshelf behind my desk and see nothing but hope, hope, hope. My mother's face is filled with optimism and love. It's hard to turn away. But it's time. Margot, darling, I call on my way to the car. I'm off. No, you're not, she says. You're just right. A quick hug, and I'm out the door. I drive myself to work, mechanically and metaphorically, and it doesn't take long. Every day, I'm grateful for this 5-minute commute to the studio. The kismet is unbelievable. After decades of bi-coastal and intercontinental commutes, almost always working more than one job at any given time, just when I needed it most, I landed a steady gig on that rarest of beasts, a television show that is a critical and commercial success. That's something we hardly dare hope for in this business. Most people have no idea how many pilots disappear into the mosh pit, how many promising starts go the way of the pet rock before a show comes along with a genuine heart and exactly the right creative team, writers, cast, and production crew. You're more likely to find narwhal steaks on special at Ralph's. Above and beyond that, this particular cast and crew, all souls counted, are smart, delightful, mellow, ego-light professionals who've become my dear friends. When I saw the pilot script, I knew this show, Mike and Molly, had the potential to go the distance. In the back of my mind, I heard Frankie telling me the same thing he told me when I started Sisters on NBC in the early 1990s. 5 years, he said with certainty. When I puffed something about not counting chickens, he smiled a confident, ready-for-takeoff smile and repeated, 5 years. The show lasted 6 more seasons, as did Frankie. Ready to wrap our 3rd season of Mike and Molly, I believe this one could last even longer. But every time I allow myself to speculate, I feel the urge to spit, throw salt over my shoulder, and sacrifice a goat. Karma is a bitch, as they say. We all must have suffered tremendously in our previous lives to have this great job. I don't want to jinx it. The main characters, Mike Biggs and Molly Flynn, Billy Gardell and Melissa McCarthy, are so easy to be with on screen and off. Our merry cast and crew quickly developed a healthy chemistry. I think people truly can feel that through the screen. The show immediately attracted a large audience of loyal fans, despite the fact, or perhaps because of the fact, that precious few successful sitcoms feature characters who look like real people instead of successful sitcom characters. At first blush, the show is about a school teacher and a police officer who meet at Overeaters Anonymous. In their quest to lose weight, they find each other. That sweetly simple premise is injected with an impossible amalgam of highly evolved and lowbrow. The moral scruples of this show are refreshingly intolerant of cynicism. A lot of the humor is below the belly button, and the zingy dialogue is boner blunt. But it doesn't feel crass because the relationships are so authentic, the atmosphere so unabashedly romantic, and the storyline so much about love. I've played broad, and I've played bawdy, but I've never inhabited a character quite like Joyce Flynn, Molly's mother.
That was a sampling of Part Swan, Part Goose, an uncommon memoir of womanhood, work, and family by Suzy Kurtz with Joni Rogers. In Watch Me, the book that follows a story lately told, Academy Award winner Angelica Houston writes about her relationship with Jack Nicholson, her rise to stardom, and her work with the greatest directors in Hollywood. Houston was 29 and trying to create a place for herself as an actress when director Tony Richardson said to her, Poor little you, so much talent and so little to show for it. You're never going to do anything with your life. She answered, Perhaps you're right, but inside she was thinking, Watch me. In Watch Me, Houston tells the story of falling in love with Nicholson and her adventurous, turbulent 17-year relationship with him and his intoxicating circle of friends. She writes about her Academy Award-winning portrayal of Mayrose Prizzi in Prizzi's Honor, her roles in The Addams Family, The Royal Tenenbaums, and The Grifters. She shares details about her collaborations with great directors, including Woody Allen, Wes Anderson, and Francis Ford Coppola. She writes movingly about the death of her father, John Houston, and her marriage to sculptor Robert Graham. Reviewers agree she's candid, mischievous, warm, passionate, funny, and a superb storyteller.
We lunched at the Luau, a Polynesian watering hole, the darkest oasis on the street, where you could hear rummy confessions from the next-door booth as you tucked behind your ear a fresh gardenia from the scorpion punch. Los Angeles was a small town then. It felt both incredibly glamorous and a little provincial. Cece, who was in her mid-30s, had a son, Colin, by a former marriage to the documentary filmmaker and screenwriter Waylon Green. Cece had gone to private schools in Beverly Hills and Montecito, and her friends were the hot beauties of the day, from Jill St. John and Stephanie Powers to Bo Derek and Stephanie Zimbalist, glamorous sportswomen and great horseback riders who'd grown up privileged in the Western Sunbelt. She'd played baseball with Elvis Presley at Beverly Glen Park in the 50s and roomed with Grace Slick at Finch College in New York. Cece also had a lively retinue of gay friends who were sportive and gossipy and informal. Cece's energy was buoyant. She cursed like a sailor and loved a bit of illicit fun, as did I. Our practice, at least a couple of times a week, was to do an impromptu raid on other people's gardens in the neighboring canyons. I would wield the shears, and with a trunk full of flowers and branches, Cece would drive her candy-apple-red Maserati like a getaway car, burning rubber to peals of laughter. Although we tempted fate, for some miraculous reason we never got caught. Sometimes Allegra would accompany us on these forays. After the sale of St. Clarence, Allegra had moved in with her Irish nanny, Kathleen Shine, whom we called Nurse, to share a rented house in Santa Monica with Gladys Hill, Dad's co-writer and secretary. Heartbroken by the death of our mother and still painfully loyal to her, Nurse had been a staple of Tony's in my childhood. Gladys was calm, deliberate, intelligent, and kind. A pale-complexioned woman with ice-blonde hair from West Virginia, she was devoted to Dad and shared his passion for pre-Columbian art. She'd worked for him in the previous decade and was part of the family in Ireland when I was growing up. Allegra was going on 9 and was extremely smart. It was already her intention to go to Oxford University. From the time she was a baby, she'd had an innate, deep wisdom and a sweet formality about her. I looked up Jeremy Railton, a handsome Rhodesian friend from my former life, when I was going to school in London. He'd been designing the sets for a play by Entozake Shange, for colored girls who've considered suicide when the rainbow is enough, and was living in an apartment on Fountain Avenue. We picked up our friendship where we'd left off 5 years before. He introduced me to his social circle, which included the comedy writer Kenny Soames and his collaborator Gail Parent, the talent agent Sandy Gallen, Michael Douglas and Brenda Vaccaro, Paula and Lisa Weinstein, and Neil Diamond. Kenny and Gail wrote for The Carol Burnett Show and numerous television specials for Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke, and Julie Andrews. Cece knew that I was still shaken from my split with Bob Richardson. She did her best to take me out and introduce me to people, but I was more interested in riding her horses and walking in the next-door garden. She and Dad had just celebrated the completion of a new jacuzzi, and one afternoon I found the actor Don Johnson and a male friend of his floating in it. Though I was grateful to Cece for her efforts, I was somewhat embarrassed and ran back to the camellia trees. A Swedish friend of hers, Brigida, who owned Strip Thrills, a dress shop on Sunset, told Cece that she was going to a party at Jack Nicholson's house that evening and invited her to come along. Cece asked if she could bring her stepdaughter, and Brigida said fine, that it was his birthday and Jack loved pretty girls.
We've just heard Watch Me by Angelica Houston. Actress and author Brooke Shields explores her relationship with her mother, Terry, in her new memoir, There Was a Little Girl, The Real Story of My Mother and Me. Brooke never had what anyone would consider an ordinary life. She was raised by her Newark tough single mom, Terry, a woman who loved the world of show business and was often a media sensation in her own right. Brooke's iconic modeling career began by chance when she was 11 months old. Terry's skills as Brooke's mother and manager were formidable, but in private, she was troubled and drinking heavily. As Brooke became an adult, the pair made choices and sacrifices that would forever affect their relationship. And when Brooke's own daughters were born, she found her experience as a mother was shaped in every way by the woman who raised her. Despite many ups and downs, Brooke was by Terry's side when she died in 2012, a loving daughter until the end.
Still wet behind the ears and newly graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, walked into this particular bar on the Upper East Side by himself. He stood 6'7", with thick black hair slickly side-parted and combed over like a little boy's. His strong jaw and Roman nose gave his face a regal appearance. To me, his face always looked a bit like the Statue of Liberties, or like one of the Greek gods. According to my mother, Dad was wearing shined Belgian loafers, a crisp shirt, and a navy blazer. He was beautiful. Mom claims she took one look at him and thought, I want that. Somehow introductions were made, as they often are in these bars filled with regular customers. Friends of friends introduced everybody all around, and Mom quickly devised a plan. She proceeded to focus on getting her drinking buddy hammered so as to unload him. Once Jack began to stammer, Mom made her move. She asked my father to help put her friend in a cab. She told the cab driver his address and then stood on the street with my dad, open to suggestions. Can you believe he just left me? Dad offered to take her home. Here she was, a 5'9 blonde beauty with legs like Sid Charisse, the attire of a well-bred New Yorker, and a riveting wit. These were her most beautiful years, and when you add in some inhibition-erasing cocktails, she became captivating. How could he resist? This was all I got of this part of the story, but evidently, she went back with him to his apartment on East 50th Street, and there it all began. My father missed his flight to Los Angeles the next day and had to make up a story to tell the girlfriend he had intended to visit. Mom claims they didn't leave the apartment for 3 days. I did not need to hear that particular detail, but I got the impression things went well. Mom and Dad began dating and finding out about one another. My dad came from a very, very different background from that of my Newark-born mom. His mother was Infanta Donna Marina Torlonia, an Italian-born aristocrat and daughter of the fourth prince of Civitella Sesi, Marino Torlonia, and Elsie Moore, his American wife. Marino had been the first private banker to the Pope and was the primary administrator of Vatican finances. Mussolini even claimed one of his properties for his summer residence, paying him only $1. Dad's Italian mother, Marina, married New York City-born tennis player Francis Xavier Alexander Shields. Pop-Pop, or Big Frank, as people referred to him, was president of the Davis Cup and a finalist at both Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. This was his second marriage. Pop-Up was also an actor under contract in the old studio system. It was said that his contract had been used as collateral in a poker game, and because of a loss, he was forced to switch studios.
That was There Was a Little Girl by Brooke Shields. When the Balls Drop is a candid and wickedly funny look at life's second half from Everybody Loves Raymond TV sitcom star and comic Brad Garrett. In these no-holds-barred essays, Garrett waxes hilarious and honest about the gaffes, the challenges, and ultimately the joys of middle age. Ranging in topics from genetics to genitals, weight to women, Brad leaves no stone unturned in this laugh-out-loud look at getting older. With pieces such as No Scales in Heaven, in which Brad points out the essential pointlessness of overthinking diet, and celebrating your erectile dysfunction during your midlife crisis, the comedian encourages you to forget the overwhelming concerns that accompany middle age and instead to welcome the laughs, even if you have a 50-50 chance of throwing your back out in doing so.
When I was opening for Sammy in Lake Tahoe, some of Frank's boys caught my act, and I was asked to open for Sinatra on New Year's Eve 1989 at Bally's in Vegas. I drove from L.A. to Vegas on December 29th, arriving at Bally's at 2:30 a.m. As I drove down the strip and approached the hotel, there it was, the marquee that would for the first time make me feel like I had arrived. Frank Sinatra with Brad Garrett. Below my name, it read Free Shrimp Cocktail in letters twice the size of mine. That was Vegas. They knew the free shrimp would bring in more folks than Brad Garrett, so they were smart enough to roll with it. A month after my stint with Sinatra in Vegas, I received a call to open for him in his home state of New Jersey at the Sands in Atlantic City. I hit the stage right at 9 and might as well have been invisible. There was a couple so drunk in the front row, they got up and started slow dancing during my act as the guy sang The Lady is a Tramp to his date. The guy was in a top hat and tails, holding a cane and wearing dark shades. I called him Mr. Peanut. His lady had a scary perm that shot out in all directions. Next time, I told her, tease your hair. Don't piss it off. The folks around them were not laughing. Just then, from the audience, a large fellow with no neck yelled, "Where's Frank?" That caused another inquiry. "Where's the comic?" Now the crowd was getting bigger laughs than I was. I wanted to die, and I got my wish. But before leaving, I did one ad-lib just for me. I said, "You've been very lifelike, thank you, and stick around for Frank." As I passed Mr. S. in the wings, he whispered to Gino, "Find out what that means." It was a harmless inside joke, but some of the crew didn't agree. As I sat in my dressing room, there came a knock at the door. It was Jilly and an enormous guy named Mike who wore an eye patch. "Hey, guys, come on in, please," I said.
"How'd it go out there tonight, Brad?" Jilly asked.
Tight. Now it was really quiet.
"Well, you're doing a fine job," Jilly said.
"Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it."
"One question. What did you mean when you said, stick around for Frank?"
"Oh, that was a silly joke. It meant nothing."
"Well, it must have meant something. It was the last thing you said, right?" Jilly questioned.
"Correct," fell from my mouth. More uncomfortable bewilderment from guys I pictured dismembering me in my sleep.
"But they had to see Frank," Jilly said.
"Exactly, of course, and therein lies the joke," I stammered. "Stick around for Frank," I tried again.
"I don't get it."
"Neither do I. I was making fun of myself. Stick around for Frank, you know? He's coming out." Still nothing.
"But they're already here. Where are they going? They came to see Frank. Why do they need to stick around for him?"
"And that's why it's funny," They don't, I pleaded as I prayed for a sudden stroke. They weren't getting it. It wouldn't go away. The room was getting smaller.
Were you making fun that Frank is sometimes late to a show? Like, stick around for Frank, as in, he'll be here soon, don't leave kind of thing?
Lord, no. That's not my style, Jilly, I said, though, of course it was. Just then, Jilly looked to Mike, the sleeping mountain, and asked him,
What did you hear, Mike?
And in broken human, he replied,
I thought I heard stick it to Frank.
Now I was envisioning being crammed to the trunk of a Lincoln. What? No, never would I say stick it to Frank. Jilly held up his giant mitt.
Let's just forget it.
Done. Thank you. Forgotten.
Okay, good. Mr. S. invited you for Chinese after the show. Small group, downstairs. You know what I mean?
I did, and it was wonderful. I dined with the king in his court, and the jester ate his kung pao pork and didn't say a word for the rest of the night. By the way, turns out Mr. Peanut was John Gotti. Apparently, I have 9 lives.
We've just heard When the Balls Drop by Brad Garrett. In 1986, John Cryer won us over as Molly Ringwald's loyal and lovable best friend, Ducky, in the cult classic Pretty in Pink. He went on to establish himself as one of the most talented comedic actors in the business, culminating in his long-running role as Alan Harper on the massively popular sitcom 2½ Men. In So That Happened, Cryer charts his extraordinary journey in showbiz, illuminating his many triumphs and missteps. Filled with behind-the-scenes anecdotes, Cryer offers his own perspectives on Hollywood, the business at large, and the art of acting. He details his experiences with Charlie Sheen, Robert Altman, Molly Ringwald, Demi Moore, Judd Nelson, Christopher Reeve, and many others. He shares the intimate details of his friendships and relationships, pays tribute to his mentors, and explores the peculiar combination of heart, talent, and wisdom it takes to survive.
Shelley was also pretty and often traversed the apartment scantily clad, which made her a welcome guest in my eyes. Our building was so old that it still had keyholes on doors. And I may have, a time or two, in front of Shelley's room, incurred a crippling injury that required me to stoop and turn my head in the direction of her door's keyhole, whereupon I might have seen some things I wasn't supposed to. The problem with getting caught and claiming injury, of course, is that you have to fake that pain for at least 45 minutes afterward. Ultimately, Shelley was the UN to our Serbia and Croatia, which really brought unity to the household. But Robin also changed. She became less confrontational and began to look at me as a fixer-upper instead of a punching bag. Perhaps realizing her little brother was entering pubescence with a target on his back, I was the definition of nerd in training, non-athletic, smallish, generally timid, and quick to spout know-it-all information as a defense mechanism, she actively worked at helping me socially. She even took me to my first concert, the Thompson Twins at the Ritz, and dressed me to boot in teen hipster duds from the clothing store where she'd started working. Although she still enjoyed making fun of me, my early teens were marked by a lasting détente at Shea Cryer. War crimes would not be prosecuted. Trade talks were negotiated. The occasional diplomatic slight was forgiven. Of course, much of the reason Robin and I had a trial by fire as fractious siblings was because, as latchkey kids, we often had the run of the house. We became particularly independent during my preteen years, when Mom began to taste success with the musical I'm Getting My Act Together and Taking It on the Road, which Mom wrote the book and lyrics for and starred in, with music by Nancy Ford, her longtime collaborator. It's worth taking a moment to note that it's no small feat to make a living in New York as a playwright, much less a female one, and Mom's been at it for more than 50 years now. The 1970 rock musical she wrote with Nancy, The Last Sweet Days of Isaac, won multiple theater awards, and in 1972, they opened a show on Broadway called Shelter. Getting My Act Together was autobiographical for Mom. It told the story of an actress approaching middle age who finds new life singing songs about female liberation. And in 1978, the legendary theater producer Joe Papp put it up at the Public Theater. When the New York Times panned it in a truly rotten, dismissive review, I vividly recall finding my mom crying by herself in her darkened bedroom. She worked so hard on it, and it was such a personal story, and we had been enduring some lean financial years for a while. I remember Mom sitting us all down at the table and giving us the grim news that there would be no allowance for a while. My dad, who by that point had moved to Los Angeles and was a struggling actor with a new family, didn't have the money to pay child support, so it was all on our single mom. In that light, knowing that the Times' influence was enough to kill a show outright, the news did not look good for our getting out of financial straits. But Joe Papp, unbowed and perhaps reminded of how much preview audiences loved it, let the show run for 6 weeks. By the end of that run, Getting My Act Together had found itself a passionate audience. The show was selling out on word of mouth alone and would go on to run for almost 3 years off-Broadway, one of the longest such runs in that era. The success, though, meant that Mom's show, and because she starred in it, Mom, were in demand around the country. She acquired a manager. Well, acquired is not exactly accurate. Getting My Act Together's lighting designer, an affable, bearded, beret-wearing mensch by the name of Marty Tudor, approached her one day and said, "Hey, can I be your manager?" Mom replied, "I don't know. I've never had a manager before." He replied, "That's cool. I've never been one before." Marty, who used to design light shows for concert acts like Barry Manilow and had done enough tours with megastar Meatloaf to refer to him simply as Meat, was tired of the rock and roll life and was ready for a career change. My mom was willing to take a chance.
We've just heard "So That Happened" by John Cryer. Wherever Chelsea Handler travels, one thing is certain. She always ends up in the land of the ridiculous. In You Gotta Be Kidding Me, she sneaks her sharp wit through airport security and delivers some of her most absurd and hilarious stories. On Safari in Africa, it's anyone's guess as to what's more dangerous, the wildlife or Chelsea. But she's always game for the next misadventure. The situation gets down and dirty as she defiles a kayak in the Bahamas, and outright sweaty as she escapes from a German hospital on crutches. When things get truly scary, like finding herself stuck next to a passenger with bad breath, she knows she can rely on her family to make matters even worse. Complete with answers to the most frequently asked travelers' questions, hot travel tips, and travel etiquette, none of which should be believed, You Gotta Be Kidding Me has Chelsea taking on the world, one laugh-out-loud incident at a time.
In my limited experience as an adolescent/immature adult, I found it's always best to travel in even numbers. So there were six of us being flown into the bush. One was my cousin Molly, 26. She's the younger, whiter version of Tyler Perry's Medea, large and in charge. I remembered that Molly loved animals and wanted to become a zoologist before her parents convinced her to aim lower and work on a reality show. If you've ever heard a hippo entering a waterhole, then you know what it sounds like to hear Molly chuckle. Her birth name is Ulrika, because our mothers hail from Nazis, and in an effort to live a peaceful life alongside our Jewish brethren, she chose her middle name Molly to use personally and at McDonald's. While everyone else refers to her as Molly, I call her by her birth name because I find Ulrika both appalling and embarrassing. Over the years, it has been shortened to Ricky or Rick the D. However, Rick the D has never caught on with others, and I constantly have to explain to people who know her why I'm calling her Rick or Ricky. So I've adapted to referring to her with either name only in intimate settings such as texts or in a whirlpool. Accompanying us would be my newly divorced sister, Simone. I facilitated the divorce, and I'm proud of it. She resisted coming because she and her three children were moving into a newer, better house, and the timing couldn't have been worse, blah, 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 blah. I thought it best to bulldoze right over her plans by hiring movers and getting her a plane ticket, then telling her it was non-refundable and that I'd be out $25,000 if she did not come. Simone often refers to me as a relationship wrecker. The other safari goers were Shelley, the aforementioned lesbian lawyer who lives with me in Los Angeles. I bought her at a lesbian auction in Texas. Hannah, my oldest friend from LA, and Sue Murphy, who is a co-executive producer on my TV show, Chelsea Lately. Sue is best described as a female Hunter S. Thompson, but with her slightly more together. Every once in a while, usually on vacations such as this, she'll walk into someone's room or someone's balcony at around 1 a.m, glue a couple of sentences together that sound as if she had moments earlier suffered a stroke. She's the type of person who, upon finding herself with a bottle of Pinot Noir and no available glass, will gladly empty the contents of the bottle into a bowl of cereal and then proceed to ingest both the wine and the frosted mini-wheats with a soup spoon. Sue is probably the best traveling companion of all time, stateside as well as internationally. We refer to Sue as 60, single, and looking. She's not close to 60, but after this mantra is repeated in front of enough strangers, people often come up and whisper that she looks great for her age. Sue doesn't bother correcting them, and more often than not, she introduces herself as Shelley's mother, even though Shelley and Sue are the same age. She's the only one in the group who is in something along the lines of a relationship with a man who goes by the name of Chuck. There are three male names that top the list of making it impossible for me to take them seriously. Chuck, Howard, and Ducky. Sue and Chuck's relationship takes a beating every time I break up with a boyfriend, decide to take a trip across the planet, and then force everyone to come with me. When the hell did you decide to go to Africa? Sue asked me when I rode my Segway into her office and gave her information about the typhoid, tetanus, hepatitis A, and hepatitis B shots we would all need in order to traverse to Africa. The doctor will be here at 3 today for you, me, Hannah, and Shelley. Chelsea, we taped the show at 3:30 p.m. Did you forget that you have a TV show? Out of fairness to Sue, there have been times when I have indeed forgotten that I do have a TV show. I've gone to lunches on a Monday or Tuesday with a friend, had a couple of margaritas, and on my way back home, gotten a phone call from one of my producers asking if I forgot we have to tape the show at 3:30 p.m. that very day. This, by the way, has never happened, but it is a fantasy of mine. I do, however, happen to be very absent-minded and will sometimes forget about an event moments after it's happened or moments before it's supposed to take place. Sue, I'm quite familiar with the television show you're referring to, but we can push it a half hour or do the shots after. I don't think I can swing it this time, Chelsea, she told me. Chuck has planned this entire weekend and booked plans for us to go up to San Francisco to see a Giants game. He surprised me with it on my birthday and even made a map of San Francisco on a highlighted route from the airport to the stadium. It would be a little soul-crushing to tell him I've decided to skip San Francisco and go to Africa because Chelsea's bored. First of all, Sue, he didn't need to make a map of San Francisco. That's a little over the top. They have them everywhere, unless the topography has changed or he's in a f***ing learning annex summer program for map making. Then I started to sing my favorite song, map maker, make me a map, show me a star. I forgot the rest.
We've just heard You Gotta Be Kidding Me by Chelsea Handler. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this glimpse into some of Hollywood's favorite folks. For more titles across the genres, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.